Book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 10, and we're going to be again reading in verse 2 of this chapter down through the end of the chapter. And I think as we get toward the end of the chapter, you'll see where Isaiah chapter 3 in our scripture reading connects up with this. Ecclesiastes 10, verse 2. A wise man's heart directs him toward the right, but the foolish man's heart directs him toward the left. Even when the fool walks along the road, his sense is lacking, and he demonstrates to everyone that he is a fool. If the ruler's temper rises against you, do not abandon your position, because composure allays great offenses. There is an evil I've seen under the sun, like an arrow which goes forth from the ruler. Folly is set in many exalted places, while rich men sit in humble places. I have seen slaves riding on horses, and princes walking like slaves on the land. He who digs a pit may fall into it, and a serpent may bite him who breaks through a wall. He who quarries stones may be hurt by them, and he who splits logs may be endangered by them. The axe is dull, and he does not sharpen its edge, then he must exert more strength. Wisdom has the advantage of giving success. If the serpent bites before being charmed, there is no profit for the charmer. Words from the mouth of a wise man are gracious, while the lips of a fool consume him. The beginning of his talking is folly, and the end of it is wicked madness. Yet, the fool multiplies words. No man knows what will happen, and who can tell him what will come after him? The toil of a fool so wearies him that he does not even know how to go to a city. Woe to you, O land, whose king is a lad and whose princes feast in the morning. Blessed are you, O land, whose king is of nobility, and whose princes eat at the appropriate time, for strength and not for drunkenness. Through indolence the rafters sag, and through slackness the house leaks. Men prepare a meal for enjoyment, and wine makes life merry, and money is the answer to everything. Furthermore, in your bedchamber, do not curse a king. And in your sleeping rooms, do not curse a rich man, for a bird of the heavens will carry the sound, and the winged creature will make the matter known. And so, as we go through here, you're probably saying, these sound like proverbs, right? These are just individual observations that Solomon is looking at as he has observed all things under the sun, that he has sought to find out the heights of wisdom and the depths of insanity. And he's looking at these types of things, and at this point in the book, he's telling us those things that he has observed. And as you notice, as we went through here, most of what we've looked at here has to deal with leadership, has to deal with government, deals with the kings of the land here. Pretty soon, we're going to enter into the vanity of growing old. Lots of us already begin to have hints of that, right? Youth don't know anything about that. They break a leg, it's healed within, 4 to 6 weeks. You know, when you get old, you break a leg, it might be forever, okay, before that healing happens. So we'll take a look at the vanity of getting old, and then, Lord willing, we'll take a look at the conclusion of the matter, which you already know, which is to fear God and keep His commandments. That is the whole duty of a man. But here we're continuing and looking at the wisdom and the foolishness of life under the sun. And as you know, as you've read through here, you're probably seeing that he's emphasizing really how foolishness destroys things. You put foolish people in leadership, it destroys the nation. You put foolishness out in your walking, it doesn't bring success, but it brings destruction. And so therefore the title of the message, Foolishness Destroys. Now I think there's five groupings of wisdom sayings here. Well, look at the first one, and that is wisdom preserves our pathway. Look at verses 2 and 3. A wise man's heart directs him toward the right, but the foolish man's heart directs him to the left. Even when a fool walks along the road, his sense is lacking, and he demonstrates to everyone that he is a fool. A man of wisdom places himself, and we're speaking in general, a wisdom of a man who is wise, places himself in a place of honor and strength. People in general recognizes a man who is wise, but the fool is the exact opposite. In fact, it doesn't matter what the fool does, he always demonstrates that he is a fool. It doesn't just have to be in special things or special events, because his heart of a foolish man, look at verse 2, would direct him to the left. And even if all he's doing is going for a 30-minute walk along the road, his sense, while he's walking there and thinking through those things, his sense is lacking. And eventually, if you observe him long enough, or even if you join yourself to him in his walk, he'll demonstrate that he is a fool. How does he demonstrate it? Well, he demonstrates it through his speech. Right? You can't tell whether a man is fool or wise just by watching how he walks. People walk the same way. But when you join with him, his mouth will let you know that he is not a wise man, but that he is a fool. A fool always has something to say about everything. It doesn't matter what it is, he will have something to say. He may have no understanding of the intricacies of playing a violin, but if you bring the subject up to him, he will have something to say about it. And he will multiply and multiply his words to where you'll sit here and listen to him, just using my illustration, listen to him talk about violin or the appreciation of music, and you don't even have to say anything. You just say in your heart, this guy does not know what he's talking about. But a fool is absolutely confident that they are right. I remember talking to an individual many, many years ago after my wife and I had gotten back from Israel. We lived there for over a year. We spent time from over there. And I remember talking to this person, and they were telling me what it was like to live in Israel. They had never been there. And they would tell me what it was like to live there, and I would say, well, you know, it's not exactly that way. And then they wanted to argue about it. And so I kind of engaged it, you know, and then after a while I kept hearing this multiplicity of words, and I realized, number one, they're not listening to me, right? And number two, there's no profit to be gained in engaging it, so I just was quiet. But they demonstrated, at least in that area of their life, that they were talking foolishly. Okay, it just becomes very, very evident if you're really listening to what they have to say. Because his wisdom fails. Even as he walks through the course of his life, his speech declares him to be a fool, one devoid of wisdom. He cannot disguise who he is. Look at verse 2. Even if he just walks along the road, his sense is lacking. And if you go up, he'll demonstrate that he's what? That he's a fool. He can't disguise that he's a fool. Now, the Bible does say that there is one way that a fool can disguise himself for a little short time. And I want you to, you may want to put this reference down here, but I want you to go over to the book of Proverbs. Just go back to the book of Proverbs, chapter 17. Book of Proverbs, chapter 17. And after we read this, you'll know how a fool can disguise himself for a little while that he is really a fool. Look at verse 28 of Proverbs 17. even a fool, when he keeps silent, is considered wise. When he closes his lips, he is considered prudent. So how can a fool end up disguising himself just for a little while that he's not a fool? By not saying anything, right? But as the wise man has said, once he opens his mouth, he lets everyone know that he's not wise, he's a fool. And so you can disguise yourself for a little while. I mean, while he's there and you're not with him and he's not talking, the only thing that would betray it is what he's thinking. But the moment you go up and engage him in conversation, then you'll find out that he really is a fool. Because a fool is arrogant. And people who are arrogant, people who are, we could word it this way, let's use a vernacular. People who are full of themselves, right? They only think about themselves. Their world is centered around themselves. All their thoughts are about themselves. They're arrogant people. They're prideful people. They think they know everything, right? They can't keep that to themselves very long because they know, they believe that they know everything. And of course, back in Ecclesiastes, if you look down at chapter 9 and verse 17, let's just engage this one more time. The words of the wise heard in quietness are better than the shouting among wahoo. Fools. And fools talk, and fools yell, and fools raise their voice, right? Why do they do that? Because they think that through the loudness of their argument, they gain a hearing. And that's exactly where our nation is today. It seems that we can't conduct conversation without people escalating their tone and the loudness of their what? Of their speech. And brethren, I want to remind you once again that it's not always the loudest and most vocal that bears the marks of true wisdom. In fact, a majority in a democracy does not prove that it's wise. It's kind of an axiom of our nation that we believe in democracy. The majority what? Rules. But the majority may not always be right. And the majority may not always be the wisest. What a majority in democracy does prove is that the leaders we elect are characteristic of the majority. Because people elect people who agree with them, who are like themselves. So if you have a loud leader, what kind of majority do you have? You've got a loud majority. If you've got a foolish leader in a democracy, what does that prove about the majority? That in general, they're foolish. And sometimes even in the media, you'll hear people say, well, you got the type of leader you deserve. Right? That's what they're saying right here. So wisdom preserves our paths. But a fool, even if all he's doing is walking along the road, he can't disguise that he is a fool. It's always plain and evident if you are looking at that because of his arrogance. Secondly, verses 4 through 7, this is how wisdom stands before authority. Look at verse 4. If the ruler's temper rises against you, do not abandon your position because composure allays great offenses. And I won't read the rest of that due to time, but brethren, here's the truth of wisdom under the sun. If an authority rises up against you, that could be in government, which is what's talking about here. It could be at your place of employment, right? It could be your superior. If an authority rises up before you in anger, don't make decisions about that circumstance in haste. Or we could word it this way. If a ruler rises up against you, don't resign your position. Now, that's hard not to do. It's hard when an authority, you know, chews you out, accuses you of something you did not what? Do. The impulse is to remove ourselves from that situation. But the wisdom that Solomon gives to us from the Lord is this, verse 4. Don't abandon your position because composure can quiet the circumstance. Right? Our not being anxious, our remaining calm, calmness of spirit can heal great eras of judgment by an authority. And do authorities misjudge sometimes? Can they not be rash in their decision making? But calmness can heal great errors. Keep a meek and quiet spirit in the face of an authority's wrath. And of course, we've seen that, right? Foolish people love to see people make decisions in haste. To betray a calm spirit, not to approach it with standing, having done all to stand. But when an authority, now we're speaking proverbially, we're speaking in general, when an authority sees that you don't overreact, there can be a questioning of the judgment. So in essence, if you're accused of, you know, being angry all the time and your authority gets angry at you for being angry all the time, if you stand there before him in calmness of spirit, he begins to what? Question whether or not that is really true. Ladies, that's helpful with your husbands, right? Husbands make mistakes. They get rash. They say things in hastiness. They come out and really are too overbearing in situations. How do you handle that? Do you handle it by yelling back? No, you handle it with a meek and quiet spirit, which is in the sight of God of great treasure. And what's true for our ladies, men, is true for you. We all work in areas of authority. Right? I remember when I was young, I couldn't wait to leave home to get out from under authority. Now I have more authorities than I know what to do with. Right? Everybody is under some form of authority, even if it's just the laws of the land. So how do we respond in things like that? How do we respond if an authority makes a wrong judgment about you? Well, keep your composure. Because if you blow up and you have an anxious and loud spirit, it doesn't do anything but confirm their accusation. Bridges wrote in his commentary, by the way, if you're going to get one readable commentary about the book of Ecclesiastes, get Charles Bridges on the book of Ecclesiastes. But he wrote this. I thought this was very wise. Quote, The weak reed, by bending in a rough wind, receives no hurt. But the sturdy oak is tore up by the roots. And of course, we've seen that, right? We've seen great winds come through. And you got a tall grass. What happens with the grass? It just what? It just bends with the wind. But you get one of these mighty oak trees that are so majestic and beautiful, and the wind just what? Tops it over. And that's what he's saying here. He's saying, look, if the winds of the circumstance come your way and it's an era of judgment, you know, keep your composure in the sight of that. And that would be true in church. You know, sometimes churches, they have situations, they can have business meetings where people say all kinds of things, sometimes loud, sometimes hurtful. And sometimes they have a misjudgment in the situation. All right, what do you do as a leader in a congregation, in a church, if that happens and it happens publicly? What do? Do you raise your hand, bang on the thing, open the text, go after them? Well, all that does is people say, you know what? Maybe that person might be right. But if your demeanor is one of what? Calmness, Christ-like love, handling the affair, then people in the long term, they begin to see that this accusation is not true of that leadership. And you know what? That's hard to do sometimes because the wind may blow for a long time. But eventually righteousness does win. And of course, I realize that by me saying this, you might say, well, what if he's just doing that to try to deceive us? Well, remember, a fool can't disguise himself very, very long. Okay? His foolishness will betray him. So keep that meek and quiet spirit in the face of the wrath of an authority in your life. And yet he sees another evil, look at verse 5, that is under the sun, and that is because rulers are not infallible, they can place foolish people in places of leadership. And that's what he's bringing out here. He says, I've seen folly set in many exalted places, while rich men sit in humble places. Now, I'm not saying that all rich people are wise. But you got to remember, back then, who got the best education? The wealthy people got the best education. Who got places of leadership where they could see and gain the experience on how to deal with things? It was the wealthy that did that. And of course, Solomon says, now remember, Solomon is what? He's not only wealthy, he's a king. And he says, I've seen kings put foolish people in places. Well, he might be talking about himself. Okay? And so here he is saying, now look, you know, even in government, even in politics, we shouldn't place our hope on politics because rulers are not infallible. They can make mistakes. They can place in leadership people who are unwise. But in general, brethren, please hear me, in general, good leaders surround themselves with what kind of people? Good people. Right? In general, good leaders surround themselves with good men. In fact, a man is known by his company. So if you've got a person, you know, who appears to be wise, but they spend all their time running around and having fun with foolish children, well, you know what's happening, right? They're disguising themselves, but in their heart and in their character, they really are a fool. A fool loves to be with fools, and a wise man loves to be with wise people. Even children, Proverbs says, is known by their company. Okay, and parents, that's really a good parenting thing, right? If your children are arguing to have as their friends foolish people, what do you know about your child? They've got foolishness bound in their heart. They may not be as wise as you think they are. Okay, so here folly can be placed in places of leadership. Look here in verse 7. I have seen slaves riding on horses and princes walking like slaves. Well, where should slaves be? On the horse or off the horse? They should be off the horse. People of wisdom should be placed in places of authority. And it is interesting, isn't it? And I'm not saying there's a direct correlation, but it is interesting that in our nation, there's a growing attack upon the wealthy by people who don't have wealth. This is like a slave riding on a horse and the wealthy walking beside it, right? And so riches don't guarantee sound leadership, but riches can indicate a laborer whom God has blessed. In other words, that they have been productive in their life. And a productive leader in their life tends to be productive in their leadership. Amen? And so this is what he is talking about here. Thirdly, not only does wisdom preserve our paths, and we see how wisdom should stand before authority, but we have multiple sayings here in verses 8 through 20 concerning the saying of the wise. The first one here, I think, is in verses 8 through 10. He who digs a pit may fall into it, and a serpent may bite him who breaks through a wall. He who quarries stones may be hurt by them, and he who splits logs may be endangered by them. If the axe is dull and he doesn't sharpen its edge, then he must exert more strength. Wisdom has the advantage of giving success. And so I think in these verses there's at least two truths that we can get out of it. The first one is this, that a person who is seeking to entrap another, they're digging a what? They're digging a pit. A person who seeks to entrap another will fall into their own trap. Or a person who is in the process of tearing down a wall. This is what it means. Breaks through a wall. The walls were built of stone. Who tears down a wall may be bitten in the process of tearing down another person. So you tear down another person, that tearing down of them may end up coming back on yourself. Isn't that true? Many times people who seek evil against you end up doing the very evil that they have set before you. In other words, they may try to vote you out of office, or they may try to replace you, talking about a governmental leadership position, and in the process, they're the ones that end up being what? Hurt in the situation. So that is one truth that I think we can get out of this. But there's another one that comes, verse 9, he who quarries stones may be hurt by them, and he who splits logs may be endangered by them. And that is this, brethren, in the circumstances of life, there is potential danger everywhere. I think we need to think about this just for a little while, especially in a society that tends to promote everything being safe. Right? That's where we're at in our society. In fact, they'll tell you, you know, you say, I'm going to the store, they'll say, be safe. You know, like, well, of course not. I'm going to the grocery store to have an accident. Well, of course, everybody wants to be safe. This, to give an illustration of this, this past week, my wife and I went someplace very dangerous. There was wilderness there. There was elephants. There was ferocious beast. There was falling waterfalls. We went putt-putt. I can't think of a safer place probably where you would want to be. I mean, how are you going to get hurt on a putt-putt course, unless my kids are there, because they hit the ball and it goes off the course and, you know, it chases people and things like that. But there was only like five groups of people there on three courses. It's pretty safe. I never thought danger. In fact, the animals were, you know, statues. So here I am playing putt-putt, which is very humiliating for me because my wife always beats me. And she's the one that likes to go play putt-putt. She says, I want to go play putt-putt. And I'm like, I got to lose again. You know, so on Tuesday night of last week, my wife says, what do you want to do? I said, why don't we go play putt-putt? She's like, really? She gets really excited. And I said, yes, let's go there. You really want to? Oh, yes. I really want to. I really want to go be humble. So we get there and I forget where we were on the course, and you know, we're engaged in putt-putt and my wife's beating me like usual. And so we're walking, and what I didn't notice as I was walking on that beautiful green carpet, that there was a hump in it. So I'm just walking, you know, and all of a sudden I hit this hump and my ankle buckles. And I'm like doing this wild dance, you know, trying to stay upright. And I thought, you know what? I could have twisted my ankle. Couldn't I? I could have twisted my ankle. And I just hear it now. Here's Pastor in the ER. Why are you here? Well, I was playing putt-putt. Like, you know, come on. Can't you be safe even at a putt-putt course? And I told my wife, after I made fun about it for a while because I was embarrassed, I said to her, this is a perfect illustration. Right? I mean, parents, if your children came up and said, hey, look, Mrs. Jones wants to take us putt-putt, you don't say, danger. Right? You say, well, what?
Fun.
Sure. It's a fun place. Can you get hurt? Well, obviously, if you're me. And here's my point, brethren. It doesn't matter what you do in life. There is potential danger involved with it. Even if all you're doing is quarrying stones or splitting wood, right? You say, well, of course, that's dangerous. You know, somebody could get by. But I mean, in general, if you know how to split wood, you don't think, okay, I'm going to go out and hurt myself today. When I was younger, my dad wanted me to get all the big rocks out of the yard because he wanted, you know, a more beautiful yard. You know, he wasn't thinking, you know, a worm could come up out of the ground and attack you. He was thinking, okay, you pick up the rocks, you put it in there. But could there be potential danger there? There could. And parents, let me just exhort you about this. If your aim in life is to remove all danger before we can do it, then it won't happen. Now, this isn't a call to put your children or yourself in dangerous situations. But it is a call for prudency and wisdom associated with it. You can get hurt anywhere. Back when I was pastoring at Lighthouse, one of our ladies babysat our kids. And I forgot what happened, but something happened and he got hit on the head and there was blood gushing out everywhere. And I still laugh about it and think about it because the first thing this lady said, I think it was Michael, wasn't it, Michael? She said, Michael, why did you have to get hurt while I was babysitting? Like he planned it. There's danger where? In everything. You could walk down this hall right now on the way to your car and twist your ankle. So you say, well, if that's the case, I'm not coming to church. Well, you're not going to do anything in life. But that's the way people think sometimes, right? They think, well, there's a line without in the streets. Maybe I shouldn't go out there. Maybe I shouldn't do this or shouldn't do that. No, there is danger involved in everything. And in our doing, it is best to keep the tools of your business sharp. If the tools of your business are not sharp, then you've got to put more strength into the word, into the work that you're doing than is necessary. And of course, anybody who does any type of work with a sharp instrument knows that. I could go and take an axe that has not been sharpened in years and is totally dull. Could I go out in the backyard and chop down a tree? The answer is, sure, but it might take you several days. But if I took 30 minutes or however long and I sharpened that axe, would not the taking down of that tree occur much quicker? It would. And brethren, I want to encourage you. This is true in many, many areas of life. You know, no man ever says to himself, I got enough tools. As a pastor, I can give you a list of my deficiencies in ministry that I wish that I had gotten sharpened years ago. It would have saved me a lot of work. You're that way, right? You can think of areas in your life that that if you had better tools, and you know, it's kind of a joke that anything you have to repair in your house takes a totally new set of tools. But if those tools are the right tools and they're good tools, you can get a job done much quicker and more efficient. This is true in everything. Men, if you think about the appliances in your home, the things that your wife uses, a washer, a dryer, a dishwasher, okay, whatever she's using, a vacuum cleaner, you can go out and just get the cheapest thing out there and say, here, use it. And they may have to vacuum the house three times to get all the dust out of it. You say, well, the house got vacuumed. Sure, but if you had just a little bit better vacuum, right, you may only have to vacuum it once. And that would be a blessing to your wife, like tools are a blessing to you, right? You get a little mower, you know, you keep the blade sharp, it cuts the yard a lot better, right? And so I think this is a self-evident rule that sometimes we forget. And that's true in business. Get the education that you can while you can. Sharpen the tools while you're young to be able to do the work that is set here before you. So, verses 11 and following, verses 11 through 15, is our next set of Proverbs. And it deals with the tongue. Verse 11, if the serpent bites before being charmed, there's no profit for the charmer. That ought to make sense, right? This is the one who, you know, you've seen the cobra, you know, and the cobra's there and the little charmer's doing that. And then the cobra starts waving back and forth to the music. Well, what if the cobra bites you before you ever start? Well, there's not much profit in charming, right? Because the cobra's already bitten you. And what he's talking about here is this, that our tongue is as dangerous as an unenchanted serpent. Our tongues, the Bible says, are like vipers. We've got teeth with that. And the words of a wise man will minister grace. Look at verse 12. Words from the mouth of a wise man are gracious, while the lips of a fool consume him. In the beginning of his talking is folly, and the end of it is wicked madness, yet the fool multiplies words. So a fool begins his conversation, and not long after he begins, you say to yourself, this guy does not know what he's talking about. But yet, does he stop? No, he keeps talking and talking and talking, and by the end of his speech, then you see that this is crazy. This is madness what they're proposing to do. And the reason is because they can't stop talking about the future. Look at verse 14. Yet the fool multiplies words. No man knows what will happen, and who can tell what will come after him? So what does this say about the fool? Well, it says this. He is absolutely certain that what he thinks is going to happen in the future will. And yet Solomon's already told us, can we be assured about the future and the success or failure of our decisions? The answer is no. But a fool, he's confident. We'll take step A, then we'll get B, and we'll get C, and prosperity will come. I'm confident. Let me give you a speech about it. And at the end of it, you're saying, you know what? This is nuts. That's not going to happen. That could fail. It's the insanity of it. A fool can't stop talking about the future and the assured results of his ideas. In fact, nobody can tell this man anything. And so verse 15. The toil of a fool so wearies him that he doesn't even know how to go to a city. In other words, the words of a fool are tiring. And the words of a fool tire everybody else who have to listen to him. A fool verbalizes about things he doesn't know anything about. You ever heard someone mutter about, you know, they'll listen to somebody and they'll say, you know, that guy doesn't even know how to get out of the rain. That's another way of saying what? What the guy's saying is absolutely ridiculous. He's a fool. And so, brethren, we must be careful that we don't multiply words, because the multiplication of verbiage does not necessarily indicate wisdom or learning. So today we have social media. We have Twitter. Don't you get tired that every time you conduct some kind of business affair, they want to know your opinion? I get these surveys. Can you tell us how we did? I'm like, you did great. I gave you $5 and you gave me the product. Great. That's what I wanted. I don't have any other opinion besides that. Can you give me an opinion? Isn't it amazing? Maybe we should do this, you know? Give your opinion about the message on the way out. You know, they don't listen to all that. They're just catering to you. You think you're so important that your one little opinion is going to win the day. And yet you think, well, if I get on Twitter and I tell everybody my opinion and I get other people to agree with my opinion and I multiply the words that are out there and I get a great multitude who are all saying my opinion, that proves I'm right. Majority is not always right, especially in a society that has no standard for what's right and wrong other than themselves. Facebook, just because you have a lot of friends and a lot of likes doesn't mean that you're wise. And it's not always wise to verbalize about everything, including the things you don't know anything about. Now, does that mean that people who are older are always wise? Well, look at Job, right? His three elder friends were rebuked by Elihu, who was a youth. Probably older than you or I, but he was a youth. And he said, I waited till the elder people spoke. In other words, if you just read the book up through like chapter 34, you wouldn't even know he's there. He's what? Listening. He's thinking through. He's comparing. He's listening to both sides. He's being silent. But if you look at what he says, he's the one that's not rebuked by God, which gives credibility to that. And so a majority of verbiage and the loudness of verbiage doesn't mean anything except you may be just loudly vocalizing that you're a fool. Verses 16 through 20 give us our last section here. When it begins, woe to you, O land, whose king is a lad and whose princes feast in the morning. Blessed are you, O land, whose king is of nobility and whose princes eat at the appropriate time for strength and not for drunkenness. And brethren, we looked at this in our scripture reading from Isaiah chapter 3, especially verses 1 through 5. When leadership is youthful, it is not a sign a blessing upon a nation. It is a sign of God's curse. In general, youth should not be placed in places of authority. Now, there are exceptions to that, right? There are exceptions to that. Can young people be full of wisdom?
Yes,
absolutely. But in general, even with lost people, the vanity of being under the sun teaches them certain things as they go through life. That's why, young people, you ought to listen to your parents, saved or lost. Because can life teach them something?
Yes.
Absolutely. So in general, young people should not be placed in places of authority. Why? They have a lack of maturity. They have a lack of wisdom of years. And in fact, it says here that if the king is a lad and their princes are feasting in the morning, that is not a good thing. And what he's saying here is this: in Middle Eastern Oriental culture, you had your big meal, your feast, at the end of the day, not in the morning. So if you're having this in the morning, what are you not doing? Working. See, if young people, if our leadership is having a party in the morning, then they're not working hard on behalf of the people of that nation. And young people have a tendency to do that. And of course, in our culture, you know, we got our phones and we got our games. And, you know, if you look at television in general, they characterize, you know, male young people as walking around playing games all the time. Well, somewhere along the line, you got to grow up. Young people play games. Children play games all the time. Right? They can take the most serious activities and make it a game. But as the years go by, and if they mature, life becomes more sober and more serious, right? Why? Because you take on responsibility. I remember my dad was, you know, he was a lawbreaker, and, you know, he hung around, you know, had gangs. He wasn't raised in an area of life, and he met my mother, and circumstances happened, and they decided to get married. And my dad told me many times, you know, I'd say, well, what changed your life? He said, well, when I got married, I knew that I'd taken on responsibility and I needed to stop and make changes. And he did. Not because he was a Christian. He was not. But because life, right? Life taught him that. That's a good thing, yes? Take your responsibilities. And so here, real leaders, if they use their authority to build a nation, they're called good leaders. But office holders use a nation to build their own authority. Isn't there a difference? Brethren, when we give authority to somebody, if you give authority, ladies, you marry somebody and God gives that husband authority, the authority is not there for them to use for their own sake. The authority is there for them to use for the good of their spouse. Amen? That's right. If a pastor has authority, does he have authority? That authority is not so I can build myself up and I can look good and you're to serve me. No, I use that authority for you, to build you up in the things of the Lord. Well, if you take that into government, how should our leaders be leading? For themselves? For themselves to gain position and power so that they can be in charge? No, they have been given authority under our Republic Constitution to serve the nation, not for the nation to serve them. And we live in a generation where people think leaders are people who get a lot of people following them to serve them. And we don't have what an old word that you don't hear a lot anymore, statesmen. People who serve the people who elected them for their good. Now, people don't always know what's good, but they should be serving us for good. And of course, I won't even talk about the chaos that's been surrounding our Supreme Court nominee. You can take the truths from this book and evaluate it, and you can see fools and wise and people who are trying to serve themselves and get authority and power and position and change things for themselves because that's what they want and that's what they believe, versus serving righteousness and the good of our nation. Very, very evident. Rulers should be educated. Rulers should eat. In other words, they shouldn't have a life of partying and social and feasting and gluttony. They should eat food for what? What does it say?
For strength.
For strength. For strength to do what? To serve the people that they're over. To do otherwise brings decay to a nation. It brings decay. We know what that is in our own nation, don't we? And yet we keep electing fools, regardless of party, because we're a foolish nation. So woe to you, O land, whose king is a lad and whose princes feast in the morning. Blessed are you, O land, whose king is of nobility, meaning he's been educated. He has the education, and whose princes, those who are under him, eat at the appropriate time for strength and not for drunkenness, because through indolence the rafters sag and through slackness the house leaks. In other words, if they're feasting and partying, they're not laboring for the good of the people, and after a while, what happens? Things decay. Things go slack. Look at our roads. How many potholes do we have? Okay. I'm not saying that all those government workers are slack, but I am saying this. We haven't paid attention to something that needs to be paid attention to. Our debt. This is regard Democrat or Republican. This is a problem. We keep kicking it down the road. So what's happening? It gets more and more potential trouble and danger. And I'll tell you what will happen one day with this debt we'll have to address, and they will address it severely, and people will say, well, why are you doing that? And they'll say, well, because of our debt. And they'll say, why did you let it get that big? And yet we elected people who did that. That's the way people are. And so we understand this, verse 19, that we are to prepare a meal for enjoyment, and wine makes life merry, and money is an answer to everything. Folks, money is involved in every area of life. Have you not discovered that? And it's especially true in government. Money, taxes, right? What's the answer? We're having a failing educational system. What's the answer? Tell me. More money. Right? We're failing to take care of our roads. What's the answer? More money. Right? Our military's not up stuff. What's the answer? More money. We need our computers updated. What's the answer? See, you've heard this from our politicians for years. And yet you give them more money, what happens? They need more money, because money is the answer for everything. And brethren, you and I need to be careful about that, because you look at your house budget and instead of being content, you say, now what we need is more. See, you're just like the government. And Solomon says in his wisdom, enjoy what God's given you and be content with what you have. Now, brethren, lastly in verse 20, we have a tendency to judge everything. We are an opinionated people. We are fools in many cases because we'll answer a matter before we hear it. Right? You'll just hear a paragraph and you're an expert. and you give an opinion. I was listening the other day. This was, I think it was halftime at a football game. And this is what the guy said. Are you ready? He said, I really shouldn't be talking about this. All right, you know what the next word is. But. And then he talks about it. I thought, well, if you really didn't believe you should be talking about it, then you shouldn't have been. So we have opinions about everything. And brethren, what you need to be careful is that you don't think evil in your thoughts about authorities. This is a real danger. Why is that? Well, look at verse 20. In your bedchamber, that is in your bedroom, do not curse a king. And in your sleeping room, do not curse a rich man. For a bird of the heavens will carry the sound, and the winged creature will make the matter known. Why should you not think evil in the secret recesses of your mind or in an enclosure in your inner house? Because your thoughts will get out. You ever heard people say, well, I'm not hurting anybody, I'm just thinking it. Well, what happens? It gets out. What you think, or even if you privately speak a word, it will go places you never intended for it to go. It may even reach the king that you've talked bad about. I remember when I was little, my mother caught me doing something. She didn't catch me, but she knew about it. And I couldn't figure out how she knew. And my mother would say, a little birdie told me. Man, I was looking for that bird everywhere. If I could have found that bird, it killed it. Or she'd say, I have eyes in the back of my head. I thought, that's why ladies have long hair. What's she saying? What I intended to be secret got out. And brethren, what you intend to keep secret will get out, and it will go places where you don't attend. Now, please hear me. When you think a thought of evil, and you entertain that thought, and you feed that thought, but you say to yourself, I'll never tell anyone. You know what you're doing? It's like a shook up soda can. That thought is where? Inside of you. And you thought it, you've entertained it, you fed it. And it's like shaking up that Coke can. The more you think, the more it shook. And you've got a little tab. You know, on a Coke can, there's a little opening. You pop that thing and... Well, you've got an opening called your tongue. And you put yourself in the right situation, the right circumstance, all that built up fizz inside of you will explode. And that's why sometimes I'll tell people, you know what? You've got a thought, and you shouldn't be thinking that thought. And the more you entertain that thought, it's going to come out. And they say to me almost every time, I'll never tell anybody. Well, you told me. And I'm thinking, oh, the more you think it, the more chance that that birdie's going to be set loose. Or here's one I love. Will you keep this secret? I don't want anybody to know about this, but I just got to tell you. Anaya is not doing right. Now, Anaya is doing right now. Are you going to tell anybody? Remember when you were young and you liked that girl? And somebody said, "You like that girl?" "No, I don't." "You like that girl?" "Nope, nope, nope, nope." "Oh, come on, tell me." "I won't tell anybody." "I do." "I knew you did." "Hey, Bob! Did you hear? Fred likes that girl." And if I ask for a raise of hands, how many of you have told something to someone that you said, "Would you keep it a secret?" Every one of us would what? Every one of us would raise our hands. Folks, the bird will get out. And it will go places where you don't intend. And remember, not only will what you say go places you don't intend, what is the rudder of your feet? What guides your feet? Your tongue, James 3 says. Like a rudder on a ship, our tongue directs your feet. So if you're thinking evil about something, where's your feet going? You're going that way. And then when you talk about it, you're actually directing your affairs that way. Right? Most people don't think, there's the rudder. But that is the rudder. As I conclude, Bridges wrote, this is a little lengthy, but I thought that this is very good just to prove this isn't a current modern day thing. This is Bridges, who wrote this book many, many years ago, hundreds of years ago. He said, quote, "It is dangerous to speak where secrecy is required. The thought is your own while you keep it to yourself, but once the cage is open and the bird let loose, who knows how far the flight may bear it? At first you think of tying it by the foot. You tell your secret to a single friend. He tells it to another who mentions it to a chosen few. The cord is loosened and then it's flipped and the bird has no more roost in secrecy." Learn to keep secrets to yourself. It is one thing to know the bird is in the cage securely fastened. And though it flutters against the bars, of course, if you entertain it, it desires liberty, it can't get out. But when you think evil of a man, and you repeat it, and you think about it, it will cause harm. And brethren, Bridges says this, the reason why you have thought this thought, even if it's true, is for you to pray for that person, not to repeat their evil. Amen? So you think of our government. Does not the Bible say pray for our rulers? None of our rulers are infallible, Republican or Democrat. They need our prayers. Bridges says, pray for him, and the more you do, the better. Think of what God's grace may do for him. Such thoughts are safe. If you harbor thoughts against the man and not against the sin, most probably the thought will get out and injure you. I think that's pretty wise. So, brethren, does not foolishness destroy even the foolishness of repeating something you should not be repeating to someone who says they'll keep it a secret? Let's pray.